Welcome to Nerds at Church, a queer feminist podcast diving deep into faith, nerdery, and the Bible. I'm Pastor Emily, and I use pronouns like they, them, theirs.
And I'm Pastor Kay, and my pronouns are she, her. In this episode, we'll discuss geography and celestial navigation. Also, we wanted to give you a quick sneak peek into our next season coming up. We're going to be talking about heroes and villains in pop culture, history, and the Bible.
We are super excited for this.
Yes. And don't worry, we'll have a nuanced and thoughtful definition for both heroes and villains.
Yes. Yeah, I'm super excited for this. I think it'll be a really great dive into this. And if you are wanting to tackle some heroes and villains and history with your youth groups or children's ministry, this is a great way to dig into that with them.
Yeah.
So check out the episode description for links to any references we make in this episode.
So our topic today is celestial navigation and how that interacts with geography. How have we used the stars and sun and moon to find our way around the planet through the centuries?
Before we get too deep into celestial navigation, we've got some basics. First up is the shout out to sundials, moondials, and the gnomon. So before we could navigate, we had to be able to tell what time it was. We had to be able to measure and understand some amount of movement of sun and moon. And so the kind of early version of a sundial was called the gnomon, G-N-O-M-O-N. And that was used to determine the latitude based on the length of the sun's shadow. And that actually is also the name of the thing that sticks up on a sundial cast a shadow to tell you, based on the position of the sun in the sky and the shadow it makes, what time it is.
Now that you tell me that, I want a sundial where the gnomon is designed to look like the hat that a garden gnome would wear.
I think that sounds perfect. I think that would be pretty perfect. Yeah, that sounds delightful to me. Yeah, so sundials were pretty early. Moondials also were helpful, you know, because half the day there was no sun. And the basic moondials are mostly just accurate for werewolves. So every night that you get away from a full moon, it's off by 48 more minutes.
Oh my.
So that, like, a week off, you're off by, like, 5 hours. Of what time it is, which seems like a big thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Also, thank you to whoever it was that was the werewolf that helped Emily determine that, but don't worry, we're not going to out you.
It is true. I did just watch an episode of Doctor Who that involved a werewolf and potentially the Queen of England becoming...
That was a very fun episode.
A werewolf, yes. Or developing werewolf blood.
I think that was also the episode where the very best weapon you can have is a library.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was fantastic. And the other piece for a moondial is the more advanced moondials then were developed to take into account the moon's location when it was not full. And so had, like, all of the charting of, at this point, this is the thing, so that you were not off by hours.
Very helpful.
In your measurement. Yeah. Also, one of the things that is new in terms of celestial navigation is dark sky spots. Why are they new? Back in the day, just about everywhere on Earth was a dark sky spot, but nowadays they are much fewer and farther between. So you can go to darksky.org to find out lots of information. There are more than 200 dark sky certified places in 22 countries and on 6 continents. And I'm pretty sure that technically there's dark sky on all 7 continents, because I'm pretty sure that Antarctica has dark sky spots, but just no country to include in that. That was my guess. The first dark sky certified place was actually Flagstaff, Arizona, which is really interesting.
Huh.
And there are over 160,000 square kilometers of protected land and night skies. And dark sky spots are important not just because they make my heart happy, though that is a valuable reason, but also According to the International Astronomical Union, who we've talked about a few times on this podcast this season, they recommend dark sky spots to safeguard the right of any citizen or any person to enjoy the vision of the starred sky. National and local governments should establish a suitable number of dark sky oases and protect them from excessive artificial light at night. So dark sky spots not only are good because everyone deserves the ability to see dark sky spots, but they also protect ecologically sensitive areas and universal heritage in the starry night. And dark sky spots are harder to find because of, as we alluded to, light pollution, which is the human-made alteration of outdoor light levels. So light pollution does disrupt wildlife. There's been more publicity in that around, like, baby turtles who, instead of following the moon out to sea, follow lights into towns, which is a great way to wipe out turtle populations. Yes. It also wastes money and energy to keep lights on at night, and it contributes to climate change because of the use of energy, and it blocks our view of the universe, and that's sad, because the universe is really cool. And there are a lot of ways to purchase, like, dark sky friendly lighting equipment and that sort of a thing. In general, the tips are that outdoor lighting should not go upward, it should only point down, and there shouldn't be any glare, and it doesn't need to be as bright as day at night, right? So you can have it lit up without having it be bright.
Yeah.
And having dimming or auto-off lights and minimizing bluish wavelengths, so the redder the better, on lights at night all positively contribute. But, like, I have a lamppost outside of one of my windows that literally I have to block the window because it shines in my eyes, and I'm, like,
sure,
across the street and up several houses from it. So that's just one example of the ways that light pollution impacts me personally on an individual basis, but also if it bugs me enough as a human who has adapted to a lot of different human-y things, it also bugs all of wildlife. And yeah, so yay dark sky spots.
Yeah, so for most of our episode today, we're going to be talking about navigation at sea, because as you might imagine, it's harder to find your way around when you're on a ship at sea because you don't really have nearly as many landmarks as you do when you're traveling on land. That's why they're called landmarks, mm-hmm. I would imagine. That's just a theory on my part.
Weird.
So being able to navigate at sea has historically pretty much always depended on what the weather's like, as you might imagine. If you can't see the stars, you can't navigate by the stars. Not to mention the fact that if you're in a storm, it's just hard to figure out which direction you're going at all. But the most ancient method of navigation at sea was called dead reckoning, and it was named that because if you failed at it, you would usually wind up dead, is my understanding. And this would estimate new positions based on knowing your last position. You knew where you were yesterday, you have a theory about how far you've gone since then and what direction you were going, so you can guess where you are today. But of course, as time and distance increase, since the last time you actually knew where you were while you're guessing, your errors increase, and that gets more and more dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
Historically, vast stretches of ocean and coastline were largely unknown, even into the 1800s, and so each trip would bring back new information of new landmarks they discovered, new coastlines, and so forth. Various types of angle-finding instruments, which we'll go into later, helped a lot to find your latitude, which is where you are in terms of how far north or south you are on the globe. But finding your longitude was dependent on a seaworthy clock, and that didn't really happen for a very long time. We'll get into that a little bit more later, too. But finding your longitude was a real problem for a very long time, historically speaking. Where are you east to west? And so the initial European maps, because those are the ones that we have a lot of information about, were simple outlines of coasts with some astronomy and mathematics helping later map development as time went on. But really, the very basics were the Big Dipper and the North Star are the main stars for the Northern Hemisphere celestial navigation. And in the Southern Hemisphere, you use the Southern Cross. And if you knew where those were and you could recognize them, you could give yourself a little basic information on where you were compared to where you were last night, for example. And that was how celestial navigation started.
Yeah. And when we talk about celestial navigation, a lot of the history and the knowledge that is shared about celestial navigation comes from Europe, because conquest and colonization and supremacy and all of those things. But they were actually like fairly late to the game in terms of especially navigation by sea. And some of the first that we know of to really develop more robust celestial navigation were Polynesian people. So Polynesian wayfinding. Yes, we're talking Moana.
Yeah.
Moana-style wayfinding. So they used either outrigger canoes or double-hulled canoes, which are two large canoes lashed side by side with space between them for food and materials, as their boats to travel, because you have to use different boats and different tools to go out into deeper sea than you do to sail along a coast, as we see in Moana. If you want to know what we're talking about, you can also become a Patreon supporter, starting at just $5 a month. It will give you access to all sorts of things, including our Moana movie commentary. And you will be supporting this podcast financially in addition to your listenership, which we really value and appreciate.
Yeah.
So Polynesian people traveled throughout the Pacific Ocean. They did not have written records, which is also part of why there's less officially known or shared about them. Although the skills that they had have been relearned through Micronesian, even to today, to continue to carry on those skills and that legacy. And they used sun and stars, wind and waves, and behaviors of birds and fish to navigate from island to island. So there are a lot of different ways that they figured out how to find one island from another, particularly because you couldn't necessarily see from one island to the next. So a lot of initial navigation all over was along coastlines, because then you could use the land to see and navigate. But island hopping was something that required a different way of knowing location.
Yeah.
And figuring out where to go. And so we get a glimpse of that when Maui is teaching Moana how to navigate, including using, I mean, he's a little gross when he does it, because he says, feel the water. If it's warm, you're in the current. And it's warm for the wrong reasons. But what this is talking about is, yeah, we're using wind, we're using waves, we're using currents, not just the stars. But we're focusing on celestial navigation. So we're talking mostly about the ways they used stars to navigate. And Polynesians got into island hopping very early on because it helped with resource management. So when one island's resources would begin to run low, they would go to another. And that, I think, also allowed for the island to recover its resources so that it didn't become completely depleted. So they could move to another place and that island could have the time to rest that we hear about when we talk about Jubilee, and we read about Jubilee in the Bible. And then increasingly, the South Pacific was increasingly populated and then developed like citizenship and national borders, and that actually trapped people on islands that didn't have the ability to support them long term, which is very problematic and not helpful. So there are a lot of kind of subsistence living and less than subsistence living that happens today because of the ways colonization and territorialism developed in the world.
Yeah.
But while they were doing island hopping and wayfaring, the wayfinding techniques and knowledge that they developed were passed from master to apprentice orally, often in song, which is kind of cool and like resonates with Moana and the songs within Moana that talk about wayfinding and the skills used for that.
Yeah.
And each island would have maintained a guild of navigators, and the navigators have very high status because during a famine or difficulty or anything like that, they could go and trade for aid, or they could evacuate people from the island. So they were very important people to the survival of the communities.
Yeah.
And as of 2014, these methods of wayfinding are still taught in Taumako in the Solomon Islands, as well as by other voyaging societies throughout the Pacific. So that's really cool. And this is like when we think about timeline, we're talking between 3000 and 1000 BCE, before Common Era, is when the speakers of the Austronesian languages spread through the islands of Southeast Asia. And they probably started out in Taiwan, which they may have arrived in Taiwan from mainland South China about 8,000 years ago from today, so about 3,000 to 5,000 years before they spread through the islands of Southeast Asia. So this is kind of the earliest records that we know of for seafaring and wayfinding. So another group of people that we know of that did wayfinding were the Minoans, and they were a Bronze Age Aegean people living on the island of Crete between 2600 and 1100 BCE. Part of the understanding of their wayfinding and celestial navigation is the shapes and the ways that their temples were and their buildings were situated were in line with different places they traded with, but also in line with constellations and particular stars and stuff. So they really oriented so much of their culture in a physical sense to that. And this also means that Homer's Odyssey was probably not the first historical signal of celestial navigation, which was previously thought. So we've got Minoans and we've got Polynesian people before them who were likely the actual earlier developers of celestial navigation. And then it would not be right of us to talk about navigating the seas without talking about Chinese navigation. This developed in different capacities throughout a lot of time. So during the Eastern Jin Dynasty in the South China Sea from 266 to 420 in the Common Era, they had two main methods for celestial navigation. The more basic one, which is just which direction are you going, is called star observing orientation. And that's based on the relative stability of distant stars and constellations, including the sun, that rise in the east and set in the west. So you can orient yourself in terms of east and west that way. And then also the relatively fixed positions of the North Star, Polaris, and the South Star, Antarctica, which appear almost motionless above the horizon, but have different heights depending on the latitude. So at the equator, they're just on sea level. And so the North and South Stars helped primarily for the star observing orientation with direction, so whether you were going north or south, that sort of a thing, and also with latitude, which we'll get into a bit more in a second. Other constellations also helped with this navigation. So in the north, the constellations that we know of as Cassiopeia, the Big Dipper, and the Little Dipper supplemented the observations and navigation. And in the south, the constellations we know of as Sagittarius, South Cross, Aquarius, and Aries supplemented the observations and navigation. And the more advanced version of celestial navigation for the Chinese in ancient times was the star measuring orientation. So this was more detailed, more advanced, and it was the key for course steering and setting the course. So not just knowing where you are or where you're headed vaguely, but finding more specific information.
Yeah.
And they knew how to locate the boat position based on measuring the height of the north or south stars above the horizon. That's how they could tell what we know now today as latitude, how far from the equator you are.
Yeah.
And later on in the Song Dynasty from 960 to 1279 and the Yuan Dynasty from 1279 to 1368, they were credited for developing the various navigation practices that became more common. And those became common in the early Ming Dynasty, which was from 1368 to 1644, and those practices were land, so terrestrial navigation, seeing where the coasts are, magnetic compasses, and astronomical orientation. And those kind of developed in certain ways, side by side with each other, and became much more used in the Ming Dynasty.
Mm, cool. Mm-hmm. All right, so historically, which is to say before the computer age, there were two main instruments used for celestial navigation: the astrolabe in ancient times, and then the sextant in much more modern and recent times. And so first let's talk about the astrolabe, which we don't actually have a date of invention for. As we mentioned in our previous episode on male astronomers, the ancient Greek mathematician Hipparchus has occasionally been claimed to have invented the astrolabe or been involved with the invention of it, but we have no idea when something resembling the astrolabe was invented, but we are quite sure that by the time of the Muslim astronomers in, say, 700 and 800 Common Era, they were using something that very much resembled the astrolabe that we might think of today. And so if you're asking yourself, have I ever seen an astrolabe before? Well, an astrolabe looks like a flat metal circle with a star chart on it in a circular frame with some curvy lines. And it's about the size of, honestly, the first thing that came to mind for me was a lyre, the handheld harp, or basically a larger photo frame, slightly bigger than, say, an 8x11 photo frame. You can hold an astrolabe in one arm while you manipulate it with your other hand, right? That's how big it is. And besides various astrological and religious applications, of which there were many over various centuries and cultures, it can also be used for timekeeping, especially at night when you don't have, say, the sun's positions to go by, as well as longer-term timekeeping, like months and years, as you get to know how to use it more specifically and precisely. And it can also be used for navigation, which was followed by the sextant, which I'll get to in a bit. And there was also a version of the astrolabe that was invented later on called a mariner's astrolabe, which could be used on a ship's deck that would not tilt when the ship rolled with the waves. It was set up so that it would stay level, basically. But that took quite a while to invent that.
Yeah.
And the astrolabe was used through antiquity to the Middle Ages and even into the 1600s, because the sextant wouldn't be invented until the 1700s. And generally also, I find, as I find pictures of astrolabes, they are beautiful objects. They are works of art, because back then people made useful things beautiful as well. They sort of have an Art Nouveau look to them quite often as I look at pictures of them. So as we talk about the different pieces of an astrolabe, the astrolabe is set in a circular frame called a mater, and that will hold several different circular metal discs, which are called tympans. You can look at one disc at a time, one tympan at a time. Each disc has a star chart on it for that latitude, which is engraved into it. And someone who always stays in the same place might just need one tympan, but sailors and travelers would need more to cover all the different areas that they go to. And so an astrolabe could usually hold several discs at the same time, it's just one would be on top, so that you could always see the one that you needed at the time. Much like you might put several pictures in a picture frame, so that while it only shows you one at a time, you can store the other pictures safely that way, and it's easier to switch them out later when you need to. And so the back of the mater usually also has a variety of useful related charts, which might include calendars, time conversion charts, and so on. And also on the back, there will be a movable attachment arm that's called an alidade. And that was an arm that swung out from the astrolabe that you could use to figure out the angle of ascension of stars, for example, by holding the astrolabe flat with the horizon and then swinging the alidade up to point at the star. And then you could measure the angle that you were looking at. And each tympan would show the stars as they would appear in the night sky at your latitude, and the mater that holds the tympans would have a smaller frame that goes over the top of the tympan, called an ecliptic, so that you could rotate either the frame or the tympan, depending on which astrolabe you're using, to have the ecliptic show you the particular stars that you were looking at right that second. Because, of course, as the Earth spins on our tilted axis, and as it rotates around the Sun, we see different sets of stars, and so the tympan would show a much larger variety of stars, be a much larger star map, basically, than you could see at any one second. And then the astrolabe would include markings so that once you had the night sky as you saw it framed correctly with the ecliptic, then you could see what time it was as well.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Those are some handy-dandy tools.
They are. And then the sextant gets more complicated, but we'll get to that in a little bit.
Yep. So another tool that was actually developed in the Arabian world was the kamal, which is a tool for latitude that is based on the North Star. And to use a kamal, you hold a rectangular plate in front of your face so that the top edge lines up with the North Star and the bottom with the horizon, and then measure the distance between the plate and the tip of your nose with a string that is tied to the center of the plate, and that tells you your latitude. This obviously does not work right at the equator, which is fine because the Arab world mostly originates north of the equator. Yeah. So they would use that to measure. Maybe that's where the, like, touching your nose, if you know something, comes from. It's not, I don't think, but that'd be cool if it was.
Mm-hmm. Who knows?
Right, yeah. And then Viking voyages. Oh, who knows? That took me entirely too long, but I love it. And then Viking voyages, which is mostly folks from Scandinavia, which is very northern Europe, occurred mostly between 720 and 1000 CE, and they sailed the North Atlantic to settle in Britain, Iceland, Greenland, and North America. And Vikings used the presence of birds near land and their migratory patterns as they traveled from island to island, as well as celestial navigation. And at least I learned right about the one terrible human being who sailed the ocean blue in 1492, but did not learn the Vikings had already been in contact with native people before that. Yeah. So that was a kind of cool figuring out. And in fact, Europeans from mainland and not super northern Europe were pretty late to the game in terms of seafaring. So they developed ways to find the latitude by using angle measuring instruments, and those increased in accuracy toward the end of the 1400s. And that's right, what you were talking about with the astrolabe and other things.
Sure.
Right? Or no?
Yeah, the Alidade did that on an astrolabe. Yep.
The Alidade, that's what it is. The Alidade. And they learned to measure the angle between the North Star and the horizon in the northern hemisphere and used the sun when it was visible during the day. They used dead reckoning, as Kay mentioned, in the quote-unquote age of exploration. And then when you add in tracking via the ship's compass, which is a magnetic thing developed in the 1100s, and the speed and the time spent on each heading and at each speed, that's kind of like some of the breakdown of how to figure out where you are.
Yeah.
And by 1700, the latitude had become pretty easy to figure out, but the longitude was still really hard to figure out. And they needed a good clock and a good sextant, which we'll learn about in a minute, to make those observations. And so the chronometer, which was invented by male British clockmaker John Harrison in the mid-1770s, could keep time accurately regardless of changes in humidity or temperature, which allowed for accuracy in longitude and led to Captain James Cook circumnavigating the globe in 1779.
Yeah, until he was murdered by Hawaiians, rightfully, but yes.
Yes, yes. And before that, English astronomers had thought that longitude could be found better in better celestial observations. And so King Charles...
Not the current one.
Right, the one from the 1600s. Established an observatory at Greenwich in 1675, and 200 years later, this became the prime meridian, providing what we call Greenwich Mean Time, GMT. And part of what they used for that was the lunar distance method, which is finding the angle between star and moon for longitude. So you find the angle between the star and the moon, wherever you are, and you figure out that distance between the star and the moon and compare it to what it would be at the same time, provided you have those charts, right? So compare it to what it would be at the same time at a reference point like Greenwich Mean Time, but also it could be wherever as long as it's a specific known reference point. And that would determine your longitude. And also, they developed methods to measure between the star and the horizon and the moon and the horizon as well. But that was kind of how they started to develop a sense of longitudinal information. And the first nautical almanac was published in 1766 by male mathematician Tobias Meyer of Germany. And it included longitudinal accuracy within a few nautical miles. So that was developed with those other measurements and then kind of honed to very, very high accuracy.
Yeah.
And just for some fun facts, the moon moves the distance of its own diameter in about an hour. So if you took a picture of the moon every hour and then lined it up, it would just be a line of moons.
Sure.
Which is kind of cool. And that distance is called a lunar.
Nice. Okay. All right. So now we're getting to the time in history when the sextant was developed. And so if you're asking yourself, have I ever seen a sextant before? Well, imagine a flat piece of metal that looks like the outline of an equilateral triangle, right? But instead of it being a perfect equilateral triangle, take the bottom edge of it and curve it downward, curve it out, so that it looks like it's describing part of a circle. So basically, the triangle has now become a section of a circle. And then there is a movable arm called the index arm that is attached at the top point of the triangle, and the arm can swing back and forth across the section of the circle there. And there is also a small telescope, which is attached horizontally to the arm just above the center of the triangle. This is much smaller, usually, than an astrolabe. I tried to think of something I could compare it to. If you put two modern cell phones next to each other on a table, it's probably about that size. You can hold it either in one or two hands. Yeah. Really, you're holding it in one hand and using the other hand to manipulate it. But that's about the size of it. And the term sextant has become an umbrella term for these types of instruments, but technically it only applies to the ones where the triangle part of the tool measures 60 degrees of a circle, which is 1/6 of a circle. Also, there exist octants, quintants, and quadrants, which measure 1/8, 1/5, or 1/4 of a circle, but those are much less common, especially these days. Sextants have really sort of taken over as the main tool. And this was invented in the early 1700s by combining the work of a couple of male scientists, although after Isaac Newton's death, some of the concepts that they used to invent the sextant were found in his notes as well. He died in 1727, and he had quite the habit of not sharing his ideas immediately or at all. Look into the argument about who invented calculus first to learn more about that. I think we might have mentioned that in a previous episode.
A few scandals to his name, as you know. Is expected from male scientists.
Yeah, he was kind of famous for that. And then a couple of changes happened to the sextant over the years. First, the dividing engine, which was invented by a male inventor in London in the 1770s, permitted the automatic and a highly accurate division of a circle into degrees and then fractions of degrees of arc. And so this led to octants and sextants, which used the new star catalogs that had started to be published in 1725 as they were inventing these new astronomical instruments. They were able to make more accurate star charts. And then the sextant was altered again in 1922 by Portuguese naval navigator Gago Coutinho, I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly, for use with airplanes in particular. And I don't know that we brought this up, but Portugal in particular had a reputation for hundreds of years of having excellent navigators and excellent maps, especially compared to other nearby European countries. And so I did find it not too surprising that the guy who figured out how to make a sextant for an airplane was Portuguese. And modern sextants also will have filters on the attached telescope so that it can be used safely to measure the ascension angle of the sun, because you don't want to look directly at the sun with your eyeballs. That is dangerous. Don't do that.
Don't do it, even if it's an eclipse.
Yeah. And so the filters will keep you reasonably safe. Please do read the directions on those if you're going to use those. And sextants are often, even in modern day, still kept on ships because as they don't require, you know, a satellite hookup or indeed electricity at all, they make a good backup navigation instrument in an emergency. Using a sextant to take a measurement is called sighting or taking a sight, because you are looking through the telescope as a part of doing this. And the sextant can measure the angle between two objects, like, say, measuring the angle between the horizon and a star, or measuring the distance between a moon and a star, like Emily was talking about earlier, determining Greenwich Mean Time and longitude and so forth. Or you might want to find out what local noon is with a sextant, the maximum angle between the horizon and sun, which is to say perpendicular. Or you might also want to find the North Star and measure the angle between the North Star and the horizon, which will help you figure out what time it is if you have the right charts, that kind of thing.
What time it is and what latitude it is.
And what latitude it is, yes. And then also, as you used a sextant while traveling on the sea, over time, extreme temperatures, especially extreme temperature changes, can warp the metal and therefore make them inaccurate. And this has occasionally led to people getting lost or ending up in the wrong place, which is, as you might imagine, especially dangerous when you're at sea.
Indeed it is. And when we talk about celestial navigation, it's easy to think, oh, we have GPS now, we're fine. That is in fact not true.
Yeah.
GPS relies on global positioning, and so there's still some amount of technology that doesn't always work in all of the places. That's part of how we sometimes lose planes.
Yeah.
And don't know where they crash landed. But NASA still uses celestial navigation, though they use a fancier version of it because of technology, but they use it today for the Mars Exploration Rover and how it calculates sending information back to Earth. And they used it for the Apollo program and to, like, plot out trajectories and paths as well. And in the Navy, there are some specific rates, which is fancy Navy terms for jobs, that do still have to learn celestial navigation, but not all of them do, because, for example, submariners don't really use the stars to navigate because you can't really see them in a sub. So, you know, they get off the hook on that. But other, particularly like captains of the ships and those sorts of things, do learn celestial navigation so that they're always able to navigate.
Yeah. Okay, so we've talked about celestial navigation at sea pretty extensively, but what about navigating on land, you may be asking yourselves? Well, the primary method of navigating on land without using a computer or GPS these days is called orienteering. And modern orienteering is still taught in the military, often in scouting, and via various nature clubs. And this method of navigating these days now uses mostly less astronomy than sea navigation has, historically speaking. But in ancient times and throughout history, of course, they were also using all of those navigational instruments, the astrolabes, the sextants, and so on, to navigate on land as well.
And the handy part for that is that the horizons were not moving.
Yeah.
So it was actually, like, much easier.
Yeah. But these days we have mapped out land so much better than we have mapped out the sea. And so we can mostly use maps to get around. And so now when you practice orienteering as a sport, you start with a very detailed topographical map. A topographical map is the kind of map that shows you geographical features like hills, valleys, rivers, and so on. And it focuses mostly on altitude changes in the landscape. So it'll have lines marking this is where the land goes up 10 feet, this is where the land goes down 10 feet, that kind of thing. So you use your topographical map and a compass, and first you figure out where you are by looking at the land around you and comparing it to the stuff on the map, and you're probably finding your nearest elevation point so you can get a better look around in order to figure out where you are. And then you use the map and the compass to find your way from where you started to a few different locations for this sport version of orienteering. Usually you want to go to them in a certain order, and the competition of the sport is seeing who can finish the route the fastest while finding all of the necessary stops. Generally, the way that you check did everybody actually get to all of the different spots is basically with geocaching, as it's called these days. You pick up a small unique item at each stop to show that you've been there. Or they might just have a person standing at each stop waiting for you, but usually that's more common if you're, like, in a forest, because it's harder to see the person and just walk toward them than it would be, say, in a flat field with no trees.
Yeah.
That would be cheating, yeah.
Now I'm picturing them, like, having people, like, standing up in flat fields.
Dave, there you are! Yeah, no.
Right. But if you were doing it in the Midwest in late August, might work really well with the corn.
Oh, yes,
cornfields. If you were in
sure.
a cornfield.
Although the farmer might not be thrilled about losing their crop, but still. Even now, in modern orienteering, being able to use the sun to not only orient yourself, oh, it's morning, that's east, basically, but also to give yourself a basic time check is still helpful, no matter how good your watch is. And night orienteering is also a more difficult version of the sport, and in that case, being able to orient yourself with the stars is still very helpful. Although you're probably not, if you're participating in orienteering as a sport, you're probably not carrying a full sextant with you in modern competitions, although I think I would pay real money to see someone try to do night orienteering with an astrolabe at some point. That would be fabulous.
That would be awesome.
I have to say.
Just as a note, so I grew up in the mountains in Colorado, and so have, like, for the first, you know, two decades of my life, oriented myself via the mountains.
Sure. Landmarks.
Yeah, but they ran east-west, right? So our valley was an east-west valley.
Yes, the Rockies run north-south.
But, yeah, but where we were was a valley.
Okay.
Yeah, and so, because there were mountains 360 degrees.
Sure.
It was just like this particular. So the Gore Range was to the east, and that's where the sun rose, and then sets in the west. And for my first call, I lived in Utah, as I've mentioned, I'm sure, on this podcast. And in Utah, there's two sets of mountains, big mountains and then a smaller set. And they run north-south on the sides of Salt Lake City, the Salt Lake Valley.
Oh.
And the big ones are to the east.
Oh, no.
And, like, I was there for, like, 15 months. And I cannot tell you how many months in I was still confusing myself with which direction I was facing because I was so used to the mountains being primarily in a different direction. And it was like a whole thing.
The big mountains are in the wrong place. Yeah.
Right? And this was before I had like a car that had a compass on it and that sort of thing.
Oh,
so it was like...
Yeah, I grew up visiting Denver, Colorado regularly, and you always know where the mountains are in Denver, and they are always to the west, and I can't imagine how confused I would be if I visited, like, Northern California and the mountains were on the wrong side. And goodness.
Yep. Yeah, it is so disorienting.
Yeah. I am also reminded, my uncle spent a few years living on Oahu, the island in the state of Hawaii, when he was younger, and when he was there, instead of orienting yourself north, south, east, west on the island, you are mostly orienting yourself by sort of the biggest central mountain on the island. And so you are either heading Mauka inland or you are heading toward the ocean. So you are heading inwards or outwards, basically, at all times, instead of heading north or south, east or west. And so that's your first part of your directions when you're giving someone directions. Are you facing the mountain or are you facing away from it?
I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I think part of it is, like, I love it partly because it's just delightful, but also because today, particularly in the United States and, like, white Western civilizations or whatever, have developed this understanding and assumption about how we navigate, that we use north, south, east, west, and that is the primary means of navigation. And it just, like, completely ignores or erases all of the different ways that navigation happens that is very culture and geography specific.
Yeah.
And that's something that, like, particularly for Native people that have been displaced from their land where, like, colonizers have kicked them off their land and or killed them, right? That the relationship with land matters so much in a way that white European, primarily settlers, just don't recognize. And that's also part of, though, why, like, a lot of folks from Scandinavia settled in the Midwest because there's some of the same climate and that sort of a thing. So when they had to leave, they could find something that was not completely new and different.
Yeah.
But I really like when we get to dig into how, in a cultural context, it happens.
That has changed.
Navigation happens and understanding.
Yeah, absolutely. Honestly, I think these days the landmarks I use most often in driving around between small rural towns in southern Minnesota are the water towers. When I can see a water tower, I know where I am.
Nice. That makes sense.
But, of course, as I said, historically, astronomical navigation was as useful on land as it was at sea. But in modern days, while it is still sometimes necessary at sea because you can lose your satellite link up or you have an emergency or something, it is much more rare to use it on land as the GPS link ups on land have proliferated excessively because GPS has always been, frankly, focused primarily on land areas. And so it's much harder to lose your GPS link up while you're on land.
It's true. It's true. When you get super rural, it can, and that's part of the, like, technological divide with rural places in this country that's really harmful.
Yeah. About 15 years ago, I used to regularly have my GPS get very confused in certain parts of Iowa, and I do not miss that at all. Because yelling at my GPS while trying to figure out where that tiny church was exhausting.
Yeah. Well, and still today, when I travel or go somewhere new, my phone, it takes a little bit for my phone to like get used to where it is because it's just not been in Utah or Iowa or whatever. And so then it's like, where am I? Where am I? And
We
it
have
spends a
heard.
lot more time searching for me than,
Yes.
yeah. Yep.
So let's talk about some pop culture references to celestial navigation.
Indeed. The best and most important, obviously, is Moana. And one of the things that I love about the way Moana depicts wayfinding is A, she becomes the expert wayfinder, which I think is really cool. And I think even though Maui at first is very reluctant to do that and to teach her, and the ocean has to like give him some butt darts so that he physically is incapable of doing it, so that she can do it, she can learn, and he can teach her. There's also like we see a couple different times as she's navigating, even before she meets Maui, that she puts her hand out and measures the distance from the horizon to the constellation that looks like Maui's hook in the sky. And that, like, we've been talking about different ways of doing that precise thing, right? Like, where you're measuring the distance. And all of the ways that we're kind of talking about have to do with, like, technology and things we build or create that do that. But she is able to do it just by looking, which, like, your hand, each person's hand is different and it changes sizes and stuff over your lifetime. But I like that there is a way that is simple and intuitive to figure it out, because you're gonna get a basic 90 degree angle from your thumb sticking out and have it be like that angle. But that's a consistent measurement. If your arm is all the way out, it's gonna be a constant to compare night after night and stuff, which is cool. And they sing to teach each other and talk about it, which is great.
Absolutely. And of course, we have the West Wing episode, Celestial Navigation, which may have been where the name of this episode came from, in which Rob Lowe's character gets himself and another character, Toby, lost, and then tries and fails magnificently to navigate by finding the North Star. Readers, it was not the North Star, but he tried.
Indeed, he did try. And also, the West Wing, of course, teaches us that longitude matters, especially for time zone, even if Indiana is weird while camping.
Another good episode.
Yeah, I like that episode.
Also, while you were talking about North and South and East and West and so forth, I was reminded of the episode where CJ learns that maps don't necessarily always have to have North as up.
Yes. Oh, that is one of the classic ones and one of my favorites
Yes.
of like the South
One
on
of the
top.
big block of cheese day.
Yeah, big block of cheese. I love that. And actually, like for my birthday one year, my dad got me a South on top map.
Awesome.
The type of map that it is still pretty like problematic in terms of how it depicts size, but I really like that the South is on top. And I've like tried in my own like language to stop talking about going up north and down south, but it's hard to
Yeah.
like get out of that kind of a language. But yeah, I love CJ's big revelation in that episode.
Allison Janney does a great job with that scene.
Yes. I mean, she just does a great job,
Well,
period.
yeah.
But yeah, she is particularly great at that. And of course, it would not be me without the reminder that if you are trying to navigate yourself to Never Never Land, as Peter Pan says, you take the second star to the right and straight on till morning. And I love that celestial navigation. We almost forgot it, to be clear, folks.
Yeah.
We almost forgot it. But how could I forget Peter Pan? I don't know.
Which was also referenced at the end of one of the original series Star Trek movies. Also, of course, celestial
Oh,
navigation
nice.
shows up pretty significantly in fiction set in the Age of Sailing, as it's commonly called, such as Patrick O'Brien's books about Captain Aubrey and Dr. Maturin, or the Horatio Hornblower series by C.S. Forrester. Both of those include navigating by the stars pretty regularly because they're on sailing ships and they don't want to get lost. And of course, there are also movies based on these series, like Master and Commander, which stars Russell Crowe, or Captain Horatio Hornblower, which stars Gregory Peck and is still a personal favorite of mine, because Gregory Peck.
And then one of the newer shows that deals with kind of navigation and charting and maps and all of those things is One Piece, which is a live action adaptation of a very, very long anime series. And it is fantastic. I like, we watched it and
watched
the season very fast, and it was great. But one of the characters, Nami, is the navigator, and so, like, is able to, not only, like, is it just, like, supremely gifted at creating maps, but also then is able to, like, read them and navigate and help their ship navigate around so that Monkey D. Luffy can, in fact, become the greatest pirate ever to sail the sea.
Nice.
Or so the story goes.
Yeah. And in the book or movies of Dune, space navigators can do magnificent navigation math through being, frankly, unbelievably high and also wildly mutated through almost overdosing on a chemical called spice. We do not recommend trying to navigate while high on any, you know, known and unmagical chemicals. That sounds like a terrible plan.
Yeah, that seems dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
For sure. Speaking of spice and the spice trade, in Star Wars, which also has its own version of spice, R2-D2 and other astromech droids are responsible for navigation and charting paths. And that's especially important when going into hyperdrive, because you have to be able to navigate how to get from point A to point B without running into a single thing along the way. Because if you did, everyone would die.
Yeah, that's fair. And, of course, we can't talk about any kind of navigation, although he was usually engaging in land navigation, without talking about Bugs Bunny. I hope you don't make a wrong turn at Albuquerque. Although, frankly, I've been to Albuquerque, and those were the worst drivers I've ever seen in my life. But I'm sure the folks in Albuquerque now are great drivers, but 15 years ago, wow, maybe they were just having a bad day. I don't know.
Okay, literally, we were both in Albuquerque around the same amount of time ago, and my reaction was, it's quite a nice place. But I was, like, there for day camp when I was working at camp, and I was not the driver of the car.
So we literally just drove through town on the way to somewhere else. So, but that was on that entire road trip, which covered a decent chunk of the country. That was the absolute worst driving I've ever seen. So.
Gotcha. And finally, Roald Dahl's James and the Giant Peach. We recognize that the centipede, who accidentally steers the Peach successfully to the North Pole without a compass and without any knowledge of wayfinding, is somehow still a navigator. We're just not sure how it worked.
Actually, come to think of it, it would have been closer to 21 years, because it would have been the summer of 2002. Wow, I'm old. Okay, sorry, moving on.
So that's a couple years before me.
Yeah.
And now for our readings. So we've got a couple readings for you today. Less about celestial navigation and more about what God does with the sun.
And what would have screwed up the navigation if you were there at the time.
Oh, yeah. Yes, for sure. So our first reading is Joshua chapter 10, verses 7 through 15. God helps Joshua ruin celestial navigation for the whole world for about a day.
So in verse 11, we read, as they fled before Israel while they were going down the slope of Beth Horon, the Lord threw down huge stones from heaven on them as far as Azekah, and they died. There were more who died because of the hailstones than the Israelites killed with the sword. And see, this is where they should have just been extras on the original series of Star Trek instead of being soldiers in the ancient world, because if they had been, then the giant rocks that they were getting hit with would have been made out of styrofoam, and they'd bounce right off them and they'd be just fine. Although, I guess I am assuming that giving God credit for killing more soldiers than you did was a compliment to God, right? Like, that sounds like them trying to be polite. So.
Yeah, but now I'm picturing them all wearing red shirts, so.
Yeah, pretty much.
That. I looked at verse 13, and where we read, and the sun stood still, and the moon stopped, until the nation took vengeance on their enemy. Is this not written in the book of Jashar? The sun stopped in mid-heaven, and did not hurry to set for about a whole day. So I don't actually know what the book of Jashar is, but I do remember back in the day when I was in my science proving faith phase, which I have since foregone, because they answer different questions about the world and the universe and stuff. But there was, like, some scientist somewhere had said that there was evidence for this actually happening, as well as what happens in the next passage. And then as I was, like, Googling about it, apparently in 2016, Cambridge scientists figured this out. I don't know all of the details because I did not click on the article because the website is not one that I care to support. But I do remember, like, the news of this and being like, yeah, this is the thing. And also, I wonder how messed up the animals, especially the nocturnal ones, got from this.
Yeah.
Like, did they just sleep for 36 hours? Did the non-nocturnal animals just stay awake for 36 hours? What was going on?
And while in the modern world, we might think that a 36-hour nap sounds magnificent and fabulous, you know, when you're an animal, that's not necessarily the case.
Yeah, it's mostly when you're sick that that works well.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
And then our second passage today is from 2 Kings chapter 20, verses 8 through 11. King Hezekiah is about to die, and God agrees to let him live 15 more years, and also screws up the sundial of the army that was attacking at the time. And this story also appears in Isaiah chapter 38. And so, in verse 9, we read, Isaiah said, "This is the sign to you from the Lord, that the Lord will do the thing that he has promised. The shadow has now advanced 10 intervals. Shall it retreat 10 intervals?" And so, if you look at this in context, it sounds like time sped up for a while and then went backwards for a while, and God was sort of doing maybe an ancient version of psychological warfare? Like, how deeply would that screw up the army that was attacking, thinking that time had just gone backwards? That would freak me out pretty badly. And this also would have been before they used clocks to determine longitude, because they didn't, you know, have clocks yet, thus using a sundial. And so, thankfully, for the attacking army, I guess it wouldn't have messed up their understanding of where exactly they were on the planet. But it still sounds like it would freak you out pretty badly if you thought that time turned backwards.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of reminiscent of The Flash, right? But weird. Also, I was thinking,
well, it wouldn't be for them. That was before The Flash.
Yes. Indeed, indeed. I was thinking, though, that it naturally advanced and then was magically, slash, via God, pushed back a bit.
That is a good thought, and I think that possibly the version that appears in Isaiah chapter 38 is the one that makes it sound like the time was sped up to start off with. Because I looked at that passage first and then eventually chose the 2 Kings passage to actually look at. But
Gotcha. And, oh, I forgot to fix the order of these. I looked at verse 8, which, in fact, comes before 9 usually, but we're time traveling right now, so I guess it's coming up.
Very appropriate.
That's what I get for getting a degree in being able to justify most things.
Hey, your degree isn't in math.
Or finding meaning in most things. So in verse 8, we read, Hezekiah said to Isaiah, "What shall be the sign that the Becoming One will heal me, and that I shall go up to the house of the Becoming One on the third day?" And I have to say that Hezekiah is like the only person that gets to ask for proof from God. And God keeps giving Hezekiah proof. And like, maybe it's that he's the only one that actually asks, but like, God sure must like Hezekiah, because God was not so forthcoming for proof for Joan after she found out that she had Lyme disease in Joan of Arcadia. And then when she was cured of her Lyme disease, she thought that God was a hallucination from the disease. And God did not give her like clear proof that that was wrong, and was very clear about like, no, this is about faith. You just gotta have a little faith. Trust. Mm-hmm. So, you know.
I mean, it does sound like God likes Hezekiah a lot in the passage and the context.
Yeah. I wonder how much is, like, just because people have been messing up so much, and Hezekiah is finally like, okay.
Actually trying.
I won't.
Yeah.
And God's like, yes, yes, all the cookies for Hezekiah. Yeah.
And now for our Muppets moment. So our Muppets moment this week is asking, which Muppet would you trust with a sextant to keep you safely navigating during sea journeys?
I feel like the answer to stuff like this is always Scooter, right? Like the attention to detail, the precision, he would just be on top of it and very reliable.
I certainly agree with that, but I have to admit, I was kind of expecting you to say Count Von Count, because you love Count Von Count. So instead, I will say Count Von Count.
I do love Count Von Count.
Because he's good with numbers, and also he will already be up all night and able to take measurements with the astrolabe or the sextant, because he's a vampire. And he also loves to double-check his math, so he won't be afraid of asking himself, did I make a mistake, and then doing it again.
That is true. That is true. I do love Count Von Count.
Yeah.
Good catch. Thank you for catching that for me, because I would have been very sad to have missed that experience and opportunity.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, dear listeners, thanks for joining us. Our theme music was by Rachel Meyer Lachlan, our Muppets music was by Brenda Boss, and our seasonal artwork was by Pace Warfield. Catch us next time when we'll dive into space travel in pop culture with our special guest, Jeremy Cobb of the Three Black Halflings podcast.
Yay!
This podcast has been produced by us, Emily Ewing and Kay Roloff. Yes, we already recorded the episode. Are super excited about this episode.
Yes!
For more fun, check us out on Twitter, Facebook, and Blue Sky at Nerds at Church, or contact us at nerdsatchurch@gmail.com.
Also, if you like what you've heard, rate us or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Facebook, or wherever you catch your podcasts. If you want access to our uncut episodes, merch discounts, movie commentaries, and more, support us on Patreon at patreon.com/nerdsatchurch. Starting at just $5 per month, it's cheaper than making your own astrolabe, which I was trying to figure out how you could do that these days.
I was hoping that's what you were going
to
say.
They've got to be super expensive if they're made out of metal, but I do wonder if you could make one yourself using a 3D printer.
Ooh. Which also would be expensive, mostly because I'd have to buy the printer. Although a lot of libraries have 3D printers
yes.
now, so I don't know.
And it strikes me that our listening audience might be the type of people who would know people who had 3D printers as well. But it would still cost you more than $5.
It's true. Yeah, I do know a librarian who has a 3D printer at her library, so
sure.
We'll have to see. Also, let us know on Blue Sky, Facebook, or Twitter which Muppet you would trust with a sextant to keep you safely navigating during sea journey.
As the ancient Christian said,
Pax vobiscum.